2 years ago today, two bombs exploded near the Boston Marathon finish line, killing three and injuring more than 260. On the anniversary of the bombing, the federal death penalty trial against Jahar Tsarnaev, one of the bombers, is on a break between the guilt and sentencing phases. Last week, the jury found Tsarnaev guilty on all 30 charges against him. And today, we'll look ahead at what's coming next. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. I'm David Boeri for WBUR.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Kevin, today is the anniversary of that sad date. It seems the pain and sadness are all close at hand. There's another event, of course, coming up Monday, the running of the marathon itself. I understand why Judge O'Toole granted time for the defense. It said it needed more time. But it seems to me that he has opened up the juries to very dangerous exposure of opinions, questions, and that sort of business before next week.
I agree with you, David. There are 52 weeks in the year. This is the 1 week that you would say, for worry of prejudicial exposure, you would not want the jury out there on their own devices, literally on their own devices, because I don't know how you avoid the publicity that follows the anniversary today and everything running up right into Monday, right into the race itself. It's unavoidable. Even if you're saying, I'm not going to watch TV, I'm not going to read the newspaper, you're going to be surrounded by people who know you are sitting on a jury that just convicted Jahar Tsarnaev of 17 charges that will carry the death penalty. How will you not approach that person?
And likely some of these people are going to return to work in the interim. They're likely to be bombarded with questions. Even though people know better, they're still going to insist on what it's like. Oh, yeah, tell me something. And then they have friends, relatives, and, of course, the exposure that they wouldn't be getting if they were in here working a day from 9 to 4 as a jury member.
There's a great irony in that Judge O'Toole granted this stay, this sort of break, this week break, at the request of the defense because they had logistical questions. They really needed to line up their witnesses, make sure everybody's here at an appointed date and time. If I'm the defense, I am filing part of one of my motions for appeal talks about this very week, the idea that this jury was exposed to very prejudicial stuff.
And who knows what they're filing now? We see a lot of things that are sealed, hoping that, in fact, they might catch fire before the second phase and get some appeal issues.
We went through a phase that was really almost all about the prosecution. There were 96 witnesses called in the guilt phase of this trial. 92 of them testified for the prosecution. But I think where we're heading next week is really mainly about the defense.
And this is set up like a separate trial and just like an ordinary trial. The government goes first. It opens the argument. It presents the jurors with aggravating factors. That is, those factors that call for the worst sentence allowable for Tsarnaev, which of course is death. They are followed by the defense. They present mitigating factors. Then the prosecution comes back with a chance to rebut. And now the jury goes off after closing statements. They go off and deliberate. And they're told to balance the aggravating factors against the mitigating factors. The aggravating factors put the burden on the government to prove those factors beyond a reasonable doubt. The defense has a lesser standard. The preponderance of evidence can lead the jurors to accept the mitigating factors. So they're making a balance, and then they come back with a verdict, either death or life in prison without parole.
Now, Judge O'Toole on Tuesday, David, told the jurors to prepare for about 4 weeks of testimony and evidence that will be presented in the penalty phase of this trial. But I think, like everything we heard before, that's a guesstimate. We don't know how long this will take. Particularly, we don't know how long it will take in relation to what the defense says and how aggressively the prosecution rebuts it. Because obviously, at the end of that first phase of the trial, Jahar Tsarnaev comes out looking like a bloodless monster. And now the defense has this Herculean task to try to prove that there is some humanity about this kid, that he is not, in fact, a monster, that he was an ordinary teenager, according to them, who was led astray by an older, manipulative, vicious, and violent brother. Now, how they do that is really the heart of the defense, and it's bringing in people that knew Jahar Tsarnaev before he was the person who let the bomb down on Boylston Street in back of the Richard family. I just can't wait to watch it because I don't know how you do it after what we just went through.
They certainly have a burden after the prosecution has really inflamed the jury. They got a run of 30 on 30, no doubts. They didn't spend much time going through those counts. And even the marginal counts that you and I weren't sure they'd get a conviction on, they did.
They did.
Several things are going to be interesting watching the defense. I think we're going to see a discussion of adolescence and brain development.
No doubt.
And the immaturity of the brain. They're bringing in somebody called a biopsychosocial expert. And what the defense has going for it, though, is both newer brain research, but also a couple of recent Supreme Court rulings. In recent years, the Supreme Court has ruled that the death penalty for mentally ill people, and then for juveniles, is cruel and unusual punishment. It's unconstitutional. What's particularly interesting here was a decision involving Christopher Simmons, a 17-year-old, a junior in high school when he committed murder. And in a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court affirmed the decision to overturn the death penalty. They held that the execution of juvenile offenders was cruel and unusual punishment. And here were the factors that they looked at. One, juveniles are less mature and responsible than adults, and therefore are more likely to engage in impetuous and poorly thought out actions. Two, juveniles are more vulnerable and susceptible to negative influences, such as peer pressure. And three, a juvenile's character is not as well formed as that of an adult, and therefore is not the result of an irretrievably depraved character. So therefore, they're less culpable than adults, juveniles are, and can't be considered among the worst group of offenders. The problem for the defense is he was 19
right.
at the time. And all these rulings involve people who are 18 or younger. So the defense is going to have to slide that scale closer to full maturity in order to convince the jurors.
There's going to be a lot of scientific mumbo jumbo. I think we're going to hear the words frontal lobe more than we've ever in our lives in this next coming weeks. But the other thing that the defense might have going for it is that there are parents on this jury. And whatever the science tells you, whatever the experts tell you, there's somebody up there sitting on the jury who once had a 19-year-old. And in their own mind, they're going to sit, were they completely mature at 19? Or was there still some development that had to be done, particularly in their brain? I know as somebody who has had a 19-year-old, that's something the science wouldn't have to tell me.
You've pointed it out before. There was one juror, the juror that works for the school department
down on the Cape.
Who made a comment? You remember that?
She said something that was music to the ears of the defense. She said, at the time of the crimes, Mr. Tsarnaev was a child. That word would have gone right through the defense saying, if we can get that person, if they look at our client as somebody who was a child, they don't even need a child. Adolescent will do. Then they have it. This is the other thing people need to be reminded. There are 12 people that are going to make this decision. Only one of them has to say no to the death penalty, and then it's automatic, mandatory life in prison without parole.
There is a case that strikes me as parallel here, the case of Lee Malvo, the Washington, D.C. snipers. 17-year-old in the sway of an older accomplice, and Malvo's lawyers successfully got the jury to spare the death penalty because he was seen as being susceptible to the influence of a 41-year-old. Here you have a 26-year-old older brother, Tamil, and the defense has told us all along that Johar, the 19-year-old, is in the sway of the older brother.
Right. Of course, the other problem with that comparison is that Muhammad, the older man, was around to be held accountable. In this case, Tamil is long dead, killed in the days following the Marathon bombing. And so there isn't a transferable accountability. There isn't anybody to take the rap or take the punishment that that jury might feel needs to be meted out, given how much death and destruction there was at the finish line.
Also, I think the defense is pretty much implied in that we can expect a long social history, often described as including upbringing, family, friends, associates, history, values, personality, and psychological state at the time of the alleged offenses.
There was interesting testimony during the first phase of the trial, and with Stefan Silver, the friend of Jahaz and I have said that the only time he really saw him lose his temper is when Silver called him a Russian. And Tsarnaev said to him, I'm not a Russian, I'm Chechen. Now, obviously, he's a descendant of Chechen people, but for him to self-identify like that is very important from the defense's point of view. It opens up to them in the whole mitigation process the mindset of a 19-year-old who came from a place where there was an awful lot of persecution. And even if it didn't affect him directly, it was part of his culture. It was part of his individual family. And so we're going to hear a huge history lesson on the persecution of Chechens.
Well, this is interesting because it will take us, and I think we will hear in this court about Stalin and 1944 and the fact that Stalin evacuated the entire Republic of Chechnya because of the accusation that they had collaborated with the Nazis. So they were put on trains and sent all the way to Central Asia, reminiscent of the Nazis putting Jews on trains to the concentration camps. Tremendous starvation. His grandfather was shipped out on one of those trains. And that's where the family, the modern history of the family starts, out there in the outpost of Kyrgyzstan. Eventually, they come back to Dagestan, which is north of Turkey and borders Chechnya. Although they did not live in Chechnya in modern times, they were ethnic Chechens, and they were clearly affected, seared by that historic experience.
Of course, it cuts both ways. So if I'm a juror having listened to this history lesson, I'm saying, well, why didn't he bomb the Moscow Marathon? What does this have to do with us? And the idea that somebody that has all that history of persecution living in a place like Cambridge, Massachusetts, the most tolerant patch in these United States, in my opinion, where people go out of their way, where organizations go out of their way, where school systems go out of their way to welcome children from all different cultures. What possibly could have led to the justification of what he did on April 15th, 2013?
There, I think we're going to see the portrait of a dysfunctional family, of the mother, Zubadat, and the father, Anzor, and how they came to this country already scarred, and they failed. They were going to be lawyers. He had a brother and a sister who were lawyers. Yeah. They were going to train to be lawyers. They failed spectacularly. And Marcia Gessen, the Russian-American journalist who's covered in the trial and wrote the book Brothers, talks about culturally the oldest brother in Chechen families controlling all the others. So I think we're going to see a portrait of a dysfunctional family in America.
And the other thing we're going to see a lot of, it was something that Judge O'Toole said early in the first phase of the trial he did not want to hear until the second part of the trial, and that's the words Iraq and Afghanistan. So that jump from, like I said, I'm a juror sitting there, well, I see the Chechens were treated very badly by the Russians, but what does this have to do with us? And then we're going to jump from that Chechen history lesson to what happened over the last decade of war, beginning in 2003 in Iraq.
Iraq, Afghanistan, Chechnya are on the boards. We wonder if the judge will allow them to talk about Waltham.
Absolutely. A little closer to home, but just as
relevant. The scene of the triple homicide in which the older brother Tamerlan became the main suspect. And that would go a long way, perhaps, to make the case that the older brother was a frightening older brother.
If the defense can introduce evidence or testimony that Jahaz Anayev was at least aware or suspected that his brother was involved in a triple homicide, that he killed three young men, that will be very relevant for the defense establishing why Jahaz Anayev would follow his older brother somewhat unquestioningly.
So the sentencing begins on Tuesday. Everything we've been through, magnify that, Kevin, because we are now going to the most serious penalty of all. The death penalty. That's what the jurors will be deciding, a death penalty here.
We talked about how hard it was on the victims and survivors to listen to this evidence, and obviously for the jurors to listen to this evidence and see the photos they saw. But I wonder if you're a victim, if you're somebody who lost a loved one or a leg to that bombing, you know, sitting through this next phase and listening to somebody, for lack of a better term, make excuses for why what happened happened. I think that's got to be probably just as hard.
Yet we need to talk about the Supreme Court ruling with regard to the death penalty. It has made the point that a court cannot be precluded from considering as a mitigating factor any aspect of a defendant's character or record and any of the circumstances of the offense that the defendant proffers as a basis for a sentence less than death. Which means, Kevin, that this comes with the territory. If you have the death penalty,
absolutely,
you also have the potential that the victims, the injured people who are there, the survivors, are going to be confronted with the indignity of what they might think are excuse-making by the defense. It all comes with part of the process, and that process starts Tuesday. That's when we'll be back with opening statements in the sentencing phase of USA versus Zahar Zinayev. From the Moakley Federal Courthouse, this is Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial. For WBUR, I'm David Boeri.
And I'm Kevin Cullen from the Boston Globe.
Finish Line, inside the Boston Marathon bombing trial, is a co-production of WBUR and the Boston Globe. New episodes of the podcast will be released multiple times a week throughout the trial after court lets out for the day. You can listen at WBUR.org and at bostonglobe.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where new episodes will appear as soon as they're released. Go to the podcast section of iTunes and search Finish Line to subscribe. Thanks for listening.